the end of every journey, there'll be friendly people waiting. California, good my home, though I loved her timber mountains, worked her fields and worked her orchards, up and down her central valley. I have driven open highway through the golden Utah Valley, and I've watched the river gently gliding. I wave my hand to friendly people. California, could not hold me, though I loved her timber mountains, worked her fields and worked her orchards, up and down her central valley.
Folks who know me call me a drifter. They don't know I'll stop my rambling. They don't know that someday, somewhere somebody's gonna make me settle down.
I'm going home, Laura. I'm going home. I'm going home, Laura. I'm going home. Well, no matter where I wander, I know I'll always find a welcome at the end of every journey.
And a warm, wonderful welcome back to Wander Mag On Air, episode 86. We've been back after a short break. We always take in the winter time. We try to do it just for a little bit of time off. But we're back in the game now, and we're going to be bringing you some more podcasts right here on anchor.fm. And today I have a very special guest from New Jersey, and he was a member of a group called the Mystics, which was the doo-wop group back in the 1950s, and very popular group. And he's going to be talking about some of the pitfalls, some of the success, and his new book called Hushabye. His name is Al Contrera, and he's really a wonderful guy to talk to. So first of all, I want to play one of the Mystic songs. This one is called Don't Take the Stars. They had a lot of songs, and one was a big hit, which was Hushabye. And some of the other ones should have been hits too, but you know, sometimes things just don't work out. Here's Al and the Mystics, and Don't Take the Stars.
Boom, boom, boom. Thank you.
Well, as you heard in my introduction, this gentleman here is no stranger to the music industry, and at one time, you know, was very famous. And of course, everybody's famous maybe for a while, but Al, you're seeing your fame come back to you, and I want to ask you a few questions, sir. Would you tell us the story of the day you were singing? Well, I'm sorry, you were sitting in Pop's store, and that was what led you to becoming a singer.
How I got involved. I think I was probably 15 or going on 16 years old, which would make it around 1956.
Yes.
And I was, you know, after high school, we lived in Brooklyn, and after going to high school, and right down the block was this candy store, which we called the candy store, which was actually like a little luncheonette.
Right.
And we used to hang out there after school and sometimes during school. Because it was more fun to hang out there.
Surely not, but go ahead. I'll believe it.
I'm sure a lot of people understand that part.
Yeah.
So we're in there, and I'm sitting at the counter with a good friend of mine, and we're talking, and a couple of kids hanging out in there, and some young guy, our age, walks in and goes up to the counter, and he orders, a soda or something for him and his girlfriend. He walked in with his girlfriend, and the owner of the place is called Pop. We called him Pop, and that was the name of the luncheonette, was Pop's.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an elderly guy at that time, you know, white hair. He kind of looked like a real live Elmer Fudd kind of face. And he had white hair on the side.
Yeah.
Nice guy. And so anyway, so this my friend, this new guy comes in and he orders a Coke, and I said, "Hey, Pop, while you're here, could you get me another A cream?" Now, a lot of people may not know what an A cream is, but it's something that was popular at the time, and it's just seltzer and milk and chocolate syrup all mixed up. And so I order, Pop, let me have another A cream. And the guy who just came in looks over at me and he said, "Do you sing with a group?" And I says, "No." "No, I don't sing with a group." He said, "As a matter of fact, I don't sing." Now, keep in mind, we're 16 years old.
Right, I was going to say, you're awful young.
And, I mean, yeah, I know the music, and I know there are groups around the neighborhood, and but I haven't. Not sang with one note because I whipped them. So he goes, "Well, you have a really deep voice." And yes, I had an unusually deep voice for a 16-year-old. And so he says to me, he says, "You know, you could be a bass singer." And I laughed, and my friend who's sitting next to me, we both laughed. And he says, "No, I'm serious. I'm serious. You could be a bass singer." And we got into this little conversation and about the groups, and he says, "I sing with the group, and you should try out." I said, "Please, I got enough problems in my life. I don't need all." And we're laughing, and but he goes over to the jukebox and he puts a couple of coins in, and I think at the time it was a nickel to play a record. And he says, he plays a song, and then he comes back and he goes, "When this song comes on," at the time it was like a hit. It was "You'll Never Know" by the Platters. And he says, "When the song comes on," he says, "you know, you'll never know." I said, "Yeah, I know the song. I heard it." He says, "Well, you know the bass part." I says, "Well, I don't know it. I said, but I heard it." He goes, "Well, just try to sing along with it." So. Again, we were, you know, giddy at 16 years old. Everything was funny.
Right.
So I said, oh, sure. So it comes on, it goes, you'll never know. And I sang with it, and he goes, oh, my God, you're a bee. I said, I am. He goes, oh, my God. He says, do you know how hard it is to find a bass? There's no kids our age that can sing that, and that's very important. And he goes on and on right. and on. I said, I think this guy's crazy. But as it turns out, you know, he said, listen, meet me later. I'd like to introduce you to a couple of guys that are starting the group pieces. And I'd like you to listen to my group. And so we got involved. Before you know it, I wound up singing with him and his group as a bass. Because the bass that they had, he got cold feet. He didn't want to sing anymore. So, and me, I don't know, even till today, I don't care.
Yeah, so that's how it all started. But please, Al, I want to ask you if you will take us back to that time of the doo-wop days of gangs singing on street corners and just how fast that popularity, that music spread.
Well, there were just about every street corner, there was some bunch of guys hanging out trying to emulate the songs of the day, which, you know, like Frankie Avalon with the Five Satins or the Five Keys. And these groups, Danny and the Juniors, I mean, they had hit records. And we knew that they were young people like us. We knew that they were teenagers. So a lot of the young kids that were hanging out after school had nothing to do. And, you know, they would just try to emulate that. They would practice and rehearse, and groups were springing up all over the city, and you would wind up trying to listen to other groups in other neighborhoods. And it was like a friendly competition with everybody. You know, you'd hear one group singing this, and then, of course, a lot of the kids that tried to sing realistically could not.
Mm-hmm.
So it weeded out the good and the bad, and eventually you wound up with a group that actually could harmonize.
Now one thing when I read your book, Al, that I didn't realize at the time was this music actually wasn't even known as doo-wop. That came later.
No.
Didn't it?
Rock and roll.
Yes.
Rock and roll music. I mean, this was because of Alan Freed, that famous disc jockey.
Yes.
Came out of Cleveland, and then he started in New York with a radio show, and he coined that phrase rock and roll. I mean, for audiences today, if I say rock and roll, they think of hard rock.
Mm-hmm.
So we wind up calling it doo-wop or 50s and 60s or oldies or whatever. I don't even know how those names came about, but still rock and roll to me.
That's right. good phrase. I want to ask you how heavy the influence of the mob was in the neighborhood where you grew up.
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in a neighborhood which was Bensonhurst and Bay Ridge, and it was actually near the Verrazano Bridge, which was built much later, but it was in that area.
Okay.
And there was a heavy influence of the mob. There was good and bad about it. The good part was that you would feel safe walking around the neighborhood because no one would bother anybody for fear that they were connected or knew somebody or had an uncle or a cousin who was in the mob. So you kind of felt safe. Bad part about it is that they controlled a lot of stuff that went on in the neighborhood. It's, you know, the old mafia type situation.
And you found out
most of the premier gangsters came out of that neighborhood.
And you found out later that the mob also had a lot to do with the music business.
Oh my God! Everybody kind of knew that they had their fingers in a lot of things, especially the music business. And there's quite a few books and information about the presence that they had. And you know, when we first started doing this stuff, that's who we went to. we didn't know who to go to, so we went to the local wise guy, if you will. Asked him, how do we get into this whole thing, he listened to us and he said, oh, you guys sound pretty good. And he says, I know someone who can help you. And of course, at the time, we don't realize that. We think he's just a nice guy, and
yes,
because he wants to help somebody. But there was always an ulterior motive. He smelled money. He smelled that he could make money with this whole thing.
That's right.
You want me to get into that?
I'm going to ask your next question. It may come back, what we're talking, but who were the Oberons, of which you were a member, and what are your memories about that time?
If we go back to what I said before about the guy who came into the soda shop and asked me to do the bass thing, he was one of the Oberons.
Okay, they were already formed.
Sorry?
They were already formed. This group was already a group.
Yeah, okay. They were already a group. But they had five guys, one of which was a baritone, a second tenor, a first tenor, and a lead singer. And they were already a group, and they were pretty good. I mean, once I realized that I was a bass. I mean, how do you realize that you're a singer? I don't know.
I don't either.
I don't know. So once I started singing, and with the help of these guys, like this young guy that I met, his name was Tony. And Tony kind of helped me along and showed me the ropes on, about the harmony. And, and little by little, with hours and hours and hours of practice, you pick it up. And the ones who did not pick it up was obvious, like I said before. And, they were either realized it themselves and decided, it's not for me, or we told them, this is not for you. So you can't really harmonize. But once we got that going, we kind of got together with these guys, and one of the guys in the Oberons decided that he didn't want to be in the group any longer because the Oberons were going to go to do a contest at a local theater, and he didn't want to. He was kind of stage fright, so he didn't want to get involved. So my friend Tony called me up and said, listen, the Oberons, we need a bass because so-and-so left, and we need a bass, and would you come down and audition? And I said, of course. And, he gave me a heads up on what we were going to sing. And by then it was, I kind of got the feel of what was going on, and I realized that I could do this. So I was like, very, very happy to audition for this group, which was at the time the premier group in the neighborhood. And I write it in the book, but I always remember it like it was yesterday. I mean, I was nervous, and here I am, and I auditioned for them in a car. We were at a drive-in where cars go, like a drive-in soda hop, burger stop, and I get in the car, and four of them are in there, and I get in, and they go, okay, let's start, and we introduce each each other. And he said, let's start singing. And the first song they sang was Come Go With Me by the Vikings.
Mm-hmm.
And I chimed in with my bass part. And they all looked, they all had smiles on their faces and were all looking at each other. And I said to myself, it sounds so good. I think I'm in. And that was it. Yeah, they said, okay, you're in the group. It went, you know, next. The story continued.
Yeah, and there's an incredible story in your book, Hushabye, which is the book you've written about all this. It talks about a gang fight at Coney Island. I think that's where it took place. Would you relate that story to us, Al?
Well, at the time, in not only in Brooklyn, but in all of the neighborhoods, there were a lot of gangs. And why there were gangs, I don't know, but there were gangs.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess teenagers would look for something to do after school, it wasn't that anybody was selling drugs. Matter of fact, there was very little drugs. But gangs got together and they were conscious of where they lived. Their neighborhood, and they protected their neighborhood.
You just fought for their territory.
Yeah, a territorial kind of thing. And, you know, now that I'm saying that, I guess it was a prelude to being in organized crime at some point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I really was not in a gang, but some of the guys that I was singing with were in a gang. And one day, like, we used to go to the Coney Island, there was the beach and all the rides and everything. And there was a place that had a big boardwalk, and there was a little place underneath the boardwalk where all the kids, some of the kids, not all the kids, some of the kids would hang out because there was a jukebox. And the guys and girls would dance and drink sodas and talk and, you know, smoke cigarettes.
Right.
All the things that you weren't supposed to do, you did. And it was all 17-year-old kids. But one day, we're down there, we're hanging out. Whenever we would hang out, we meeting the group, we would sing, and everybody would get around and listen, and it was fun. But one day, somebody said, you know, the gang from up in Harlem is coming down, or up in the Bronx, I forget what it was, but they're coming down and there's a fight. So all of a sudden, everybody started to collect bats and soda bottles, and, you know, the heavy coke bottles. And I'm saying, what the hell is going on? Now, all the girls left from under the boardwalk and went out onto the beach. And there was a bunch of guys left, including a motorcycle gang, which also hung out there. And then when these guys come down, also another kind of motorcycle gang, they came down and they started walking in underneath the boardwalk. And all of a sudden, it was bedlam. They were hitting each other and throwing. I was hiding behind my friend.
Okay, you're just watching this. You're not actually involved in this, right?
I had to get involved.
Oh, yeah.
I was never in anything like that.
Yeah.
And it was scary. I'll tell you what, it was scary. But, you know, you have to be involved. I mean, somebody's coming up to you.
Oh, yeah, self-defense.
Trying to hit you with a chain. You kind of, like, figure out how to get around it. So that was one of the craziest things that happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to avoid all of that later on, but it was pretty scary.
Yeah, and Al, I want to ask you now, there was a record producer named Jimmy Doyle. He was suggested a name change for your band, but it wasn't the best suggestion. So tell me about that and how you became the Mystics.
When we contacted this wise guy
a local wise guy, he said he would help us out. He introduced us to this guy, Jimmy Doyle. He was a musician, but he was kind of like not in the 50s. He was a musician from the 40s. Yeah, and but he knew his way around the recording studios. And the point was to make a demo record. And a demo record is what you needed to bring up to the recording companies, the record companies, so that they could hear what you sounded like. He said, I'm gonna rent a studio and do this and I'm gonna do that. And it's gonna cost you guys $500. And I said, $500? $500 in 1958 was like $5,000.
Yeah,
we didn't have that kind of, we didn't even have a job. You know? We were like kids. So we borrowed the money from our parents. We tried to go to the bank to get a bank loan.
Uh-huh.
We walk in the bank and, five young kids walk into a bank and we tried to go to the first desk we saw.
Yeah.
And we say to the guy behind the desk in the suit and a tie, listen, you want a loan? And he was kind of like smirking because he realized we didn't know what we were talking about.
And you're all under 20 years old.
Yeah, yeah. But he says, what do you need the loan for? I said, well, we're going to record a record and we're going to make a lot of money and we'll pay you back. We didn't know what it was all about. So he goes, okay, do you have any collateral? And we all just got into silent mode and looked at each other. And so he says, well, what's collateral? He says, collateral means you have to have put something up to make sure that if you can't pay the loan, that we can collect our money. Oh, so we have to get or you can get somebody to co-sign for you. So we wound up, because we had no collateral, so we wound up having like one of the guys in the group's father sign for the loan, and we got the loan. But back to Jimmy Doyle. So Jimmy Doyle says, oh yeah, okay, we're going to record, and at the time our name was The Overall.
Right.
I don't like that name. He says, I'm going to change your name to The Cortesians. And he says, okay, whatever. And then that afternoon, one of the guys in the farm, I think it was Bobby, went back, and he looked up the Cortesians in the dictionary, and it says, woman of the court, like,
more or less.
Bad, woman who would look for money for sex.
Like a prostitute.
Yeah. So we ran back. I said, do you know what this means? He goes, no, I don't know what it means. He says, I saw it. I was watching a movie and I heard that name. And I said, well, if we told him what it means, he goes, oh my God, I'm sorry. All of that. We went through the whole thing. So that night, we decided to pick our own name. And each one of us says, well, here's what we're going to do. With five of us, we'll all find a name. And then when we get together tomorrow, we'll put it in fold it up in a piece of paper, we'll put it in a hat, and Bobby will pick out one of those papers. And whatever it is, no argument, whatever that name is, it'll be it. So we all agree. Now, I have to, because we were looking at the dictionary earlier, I have to go in the dictionary and I'm flipping through. I open up the dictionary and it's into the M section. And I look down and there's Mystics.
Mystics.
And I said, well, that would be a cool name. So I wrote that on the paper. We got together. Bobby picked it out. And we became the Mystics. How weird.
So actually, you're the one that named the group.
Yeah, well, we all we
How did the Mystics narrowly miss recording the famous song Teenager in Love?
Once we got with a manager, we didn't get a record company right away. We got a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And our manager's name was Jim Gribble. Jim, we auditioned for him. He heard our demo recordings. And then he said, come up in my office. I want to talk to you guys. I think I want to manage you. And we were thrilled to death. We never told them that we already had a manager who was a wise guy back in Brooklyn.
Yeah, this.
So we were afraid to tell him because he was the real deal. So we go back in the office and he says, I'm going to make a phone call. And he calls up Rory Records, which is the label that Dion and the Belmonts were on. And he says, tell them that I'm bringing a group over and, you know, they're going to audition for you live. So that's what we did. We went off to Rory Records. We auditioned live. Rory liked the sound. They says, oh, we're gonna get a songwriter, songwriting team that we know to write a song for you. We said, oh, fine. I mean, we had some original stuff, but it wasn't anything that they really wanted to record. So we go back a couple of days later, and there's sitting in the studio, the record company is Doc Parnas and Morty Schumann. Very, very famous songwriters.
They're very famous songwriters, yes. They wrote some songs for Elvis.
Oh, they wrote Elvis, they wrote The Drifters, they wrote, it was amazing.
Yep.
Amazing. And they got even more famous after we got involved with them. Not because of us,
yeah,
but just because of all the songs they wrote. So, anyway, they came and they said, well, we have this song that we think you'll like. And they played on the piano and Morty sang the lyrics for Teenager in Love. We said, wow, what a great song. Mm. This is perfect. And we learned the song overnight. And when we went back the next day, the record company said, you know what? We decided that we're not going to give you guys the song. And we were heartbroken. Why? You know what? Well, he says, because it's so good. If we give it to you, you're very likely to get a hit with it, but you won't have as big a hit as if we gave it to Dion and the Belmonts. And I said, look, who are we to argue?
Yeah.
You know, we're kids, at the time, I was maybe 18 now, 18 or 19, and these guys are in business to make money. So they explained to us, we will have a monster hit if we give this song to Dion and the Belmonts. And we'll ask Doc and Morty to write you another song.
Yeah. You're seeing how it works.
Morty,
mm-hmm. Huh? You're seeing how the business works now. How the show business.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So we come back and the next day, and Doc and Morty are there. And you know, they said, well, we wrote you another song. And they played Hushabye. And we were, like, blown away. I was blown away myself. How could you write a fantastic song and then write another one the very next day? And we loved Hushabye as soon as we heard it.
Oh, it's a great song.
And we learned it right away. It was incredible. Just incredible. And then we got right on schedule. Rory Records wanted to record it right away. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I want to ask you one more question about that, and we're going to take a quick break about the history of that song and how quickly it went up the charts.
Oh, my God. Well, I think we recorded it around June of 1959. A little bit before.
Yeah, before that, yes.
Like in May of 1959, because it came out in June. And a our manager said to us, you know, we would go back and forth to do schoolwork. We had another song that we recorded for the B-side, a song called Adam and Eve. And then our manager said, you know, guys, you're going to have to, I'm working on a tour for you guys. We all had jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, this tour is going to be like 24 one-nighters in a row. And we looked at each other and said, well, we can't do that. I said, we have jobs. He goes, well, you don't have jobs anymore. This is your job now. this is what you do. And we were like, he says, this is what you wished for. You got it. Now you have to do it. And we were like stunned. Actually, I was stunned. I mean, I grew up in a family that everybody worked, you know. And to me, this wasn't work. This was fun. This was something that you do because you love to do it. As it turns out, it was fantastic because, you know, we booked this tour. And there's another story that goes with this tour, which we'll get in after the break.
Yeah, I was going to ask you before I take this quick break, too. Yeah. Did he tell you, do you even know how much you were going to be paid at this time?
Well, sure. They gave, I think the whole tour, and this is going to sound weird because we're in 2021, but the whole tour, it was around $3,000.
Okay, so.
And that was for all five of us. for 24 days on the road. And we had a start in Chicago. First time we were on a plane, they flew us out to Chicago. It was amazing.
Okay, we'll get back to it here in just a bit, Al.
Okie doke.
Okay. Just in case you might want to know more about any of our books or programs or anything we're doing here at the Wandering Press, I want to give you some contact information, and you can write to us, and we'll get that back to you. So you can reach us at Wandering Press, that's WANDERING, Wandering Press, Post Office Box 153, Crayville, Illinois, 62844. Wandering Press, Post Office Box 153, Crayville, Illinois, 62844. Or if you want to email us, it's wandermag2003@yahoo.com.
Bum, bum.
I'm with Al Contreras, member of the Mystics, and I guess you know, before I ask my next question, you still perform once in a while today, don't you, Al?
Oh, sure, sure. I perform occasionally with the Mystics, but I've been performing for the last 25 years with the Classics.
The Classics.
You know, the Till Then song. And I want to give you just a quick reason why.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Back at the time when we first met our manager, we singing on Three Corners. There were so many guys singing on Three Corners that we had to break up into three groups, and we formed the Mystics. We formed the Passions, who had a song called Just to Be with You, big hit, and then we formed the Classics, which had Till Then. Now, when none of the groups had hit records, but we all were hanging out in Brooklyn singing. Now, when we got our hit record, we told our manager that, look, we and so good friends of ours that have a great group, and he said, we'll bring them up. We brought up the Passions, and he recorded them, and they had that hit record Just to Be with You, and then we brought up the Classics, and they had a hit record, and it's called Till Then. And we're all friends. We sang in and out of each other's groups all these years, all 50 some odd years, and we're still friends. We're still friends of the people who are still around. Unfortunately, you get old. Mm-hmm. Some people don't make it.
And you've been on some of the PBS specials, you told me one time.
Oh, yeah. We've been on, I've been on a PBS special with the Mystics a couple of times and with the Classics a couple of times. And also, the three groups, we formed what we call the Brooklyn Reunion, which all three groups perform a separate show. And we're all on stage at the same time. And we performed... We did that on I think the PBS special. I think we did that once there too. But we actually have a show coming up this November if everything is okay.
Uh-huh.
A cruise out of Florida where we're going to do the Brooklyn Reunion, which we have the three groups combined for. It's called the Morph Shop Memories.
Oh, wow. That's a good name.
And it's incredible. Incredible. Big, 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 big. The entire ship is dedicated to the music. Hmm. And this year, coming up, is the, let me see, I think the headline is Gladys Knight is a headliner. I think there's, like, sometimes, we did a bunch of these. Sometimes the Beach Boys are on it. The Righteous Brothers are on this one. I mean, there's like 30 different acts that are on the show. It's great.
Sounds incredible.
Anyway, sorry to.
Oh, that's fine. And you know, when it gets closer to that time, let me know, and I'll make sure I mention it to all my listeners about that too.
Oh, fantastic! Well, you could just go on. You can Google Malt Shop Memory Cruise. November 2021.
Okay, all right. We're hoping you get to make that cruise.
Me too.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to make it next week.
Yeah. Now February 3rd. Yeah, February 3rd, 1959. It's perhaps the most important date in rock and roll history. Can you give us your memories of the winter dance party and what they call the day the music died?
February 3rd is when around our second record had just come out, and we heard the news that this happened. We were devastated, totally devastated.
Yeah, with Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper were killed.
Ritchie Valens, and of course we knew we knew Dion and the Belmont. They were friends of ours because we were on the same record label. Mm-hmm. So we were very concerned because we knew they were on that tour. And we were scheduled for the following tour. The following tour.
Which was that summer. Yeah,
that summer was going to be called the, I believe it was going to be called the Vacation Dance Party, which was going to, which was going to the same exact locations as that tour went through. And so, of course, everybody in the music business was devastated. And
so
horrible.
This winter tour that Buddy Holly was on, it was, I guess, took place in some of the worst weather they'd had in quite a while. Is that right?
Yeah,
and
well,
they got on a plane. Yeah, it's not good to talk about. Yeah, but it did change things, didn't it? A lot of things changed after that.
Oh, sure. But of course, they were on a bus which we hadn't gone yet. But that summer we went on a similar tour, same 24 cities. But knowing the bus that we went on, I realized later why they decided not to stay on the bus, because the buses were old, 1959. These buses were probably 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, they weren't brand new buses for sure.
Not a good ride.
And it was not a comfortable ride. It was probably cold as heck to be on that bus. Because when we went the following summer, the bus had no air conditioning, so it was hot. But So but I realized that that was the reason why they did that, and it was just a horrible situation.
So talking about that summer tour, I'm sure you met, and by that time you probably had met a lot of people, who were famous in the business or became famous. And you also appeared on Dick Clark TV with Dick Clark.
Oh yeah, well the first Dick Clark appearance we did was this Saturday night appearance. We were actually on tour that summer. We were actually on tour and somewhere out in the Midwest. I don't remember exactly what city we were in, but they flew us into New York in the afternoon. We flew into New York. We did the Saturday night Beach Nut Gum Dick Clark show. And
it wasn't Bandstand yet, right? Wasn't called Bandstand.
Bandstand was Bandstand, but Bandstand was out of Philadelphia.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They did it every day.
I didn't realize that. I thought it was weekly.
Yeah, after school. Mm-hmm. And this Dick Clark finally got, he was so popular, he got a Saturday night TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And so they flew us out to do this. They flew us to New York. We did the TV show. I think, I don't remember who was on the show with us. I can't remember, but it's in the book. I have to go back and remember. But I think John Saxon was on the show. Oh, no, not John Saxon. Sam Cooke was on the show.
Sam Cooke, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and a few other acts. So anyway, we did that show. And the next day, which was Sunday, we flew back and caught up with the tour. Which was now this today that would sound like, oh, it's nothing, it's no big deal, but in 1959 it was a really big deal, because those things just didn't happen. We just we were five young guys from Brooklyn, New York, and all of a sudden we're flying all over the country and television shows.
This all happened. This all happened in a very short time too. I mean, not like you.
Yeah, within months.
Yeah, 1958.
Well,
In 1958, you weren't
yeah.
even, you know, you started calling yourselves the Mystics. The next thing you know, you're making hit record. I have to ask you, we mentioned him earlier, that did you ever get a chance to meet Elvis?
No.
No,
I never.
You didn't.
I don't, none of us ever met Elvis. But it was, you know, it was, I would have loved to meet him, but you know, I think we were in different zones.
Yeah, different. Yeah, well, he went into the Army about that time too, didn't he? 1958.
I think, yeah, I'm not sure.
I think he was out. He was out of the picture for a couple of years. And when he came back, he sort of just he started making movies. He's you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at that point, we didn't even have a chance of meeting him.
Yeah.
I came close to meeting him when he started to work in Las Vegas because I used to be out in Vegas often.
Uh-huh.
And, but we never got to meet. But I would have loved to meet him.
After the success of Hushabye, can you describe the desperation, if you will, for the Mystics to produce another hit record? Because I'm sure you wanted to follow that up with another hit record.
Well, we were constantly trying to follow it up with another hit record. And, you know, we became friends with other groups in our category, like, you know, the Crest, Johnny Maestro and the Crest.
Uh-huh.
Skyline is because all we were all on a show in at the Brooklyn Fox with Alan Freed, and on the show just looked into this lineup, which was incredible. Jimmy Clanton, Dion and the Belmont, the Skyline, the Crest, Bo Diddley, the Mystics, the Tempos, Jerry Granahan, Lloyd Price, and headlined by Jackie Wilson. So we knew we got to meet all these people,
mm-hmm.
and we were friends. And so we would call each other up and say, what's going on, what's going on? So at the time, most of these acts, almost all of the acts, were always trying to get that next record because you could get on the charts, you know, like Cashbox and Billboard, and you could be on the charts, and then it only lasts for 14 weeks.
Yeah.
Now your record number starts to come down, and you're in a panic trying to come out with another record to keep you on the charts. So here we were from, you know, kids who knew nothing about the record business, all of a sudden, we want to come out with another record right away because we like this feeling of, you know, of being musicians and record act. So yeah, we would bug the record company, you know, get us some good songwriters, get some people in here, and yeah, unfortunately we never really followed up with as big a hit as Hushabye, but part of the problem was. Our second recording did fairly well, but not as good as Hushabye.
Is there a song that you really like that you thought could have been a hit besides Hushabye that you guys did?
I really loved Hushabye. I mean, I thought it was the moment I heard it, I think
mm-hmm.
it was going to be a big hit. I mean, just because of the nature of it. But I kind of liked Don't Take the Stars. I thought that was a really good, that was our follow-up.
Yep.
But it actually wasn't our follow-up. The other side of Don't Take the Stars, which was So Tenderly,
yes.
was actually the record company's follow-up. I really liked Don't Take the Stars, but they released So Tenderly, and what happened is didn't do well, and when the DJs started to play records, which was the people who actually made or broke a hit, they turned the record over, because it was a 45 at the time, and they turned the record over, and they started playing Don't Take the Stars, and so it charted in the 80s,
number 80, 85 or 84, something like that. But it charted. But I think that what the problem was is that if Lori Records would have released Don't Take the Stars as the follow-up to Hush Goodbye, I think it would have went further. But we lost that time frame in between. And it's funny how all of a sudden we knew all about the record business.
And Hush Goodbye went to number 20? Is that
Hush Goodbye hit, number 20 on the national charts. And was in most of top 10 on most of the cities in the country and overseas. There's a funny fact about Hush Goodbye and Don't Take the Stars and the following record. In Honolulu, Hawaii, Hush Goodbye was number one for many, many weeks. Don't Take the Stars was number one. And All Through the Night, which was the next song followed up, was number one. I have no explanation why.
Yeah.
but we never got to go there.
Well, you got to wonder too. You hear about these singers who don't really hit it big in the United States, but they're famous in England. And you heard about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It happens all the time. Yeah. Well, there's no rhyme or reason for all this.
You sort of recorded a version of The Lion Sleeps Tonight, didn't you? It was a song called Weem Away.
Oh, we did. Yeah, we did Weem Away way back in the beginning of one of our first recording sessions when we recorded Hush Goodbye and Adam and Eve and Weem Away. And Weem Away was the version that we recorded was done by the Weavers, and it was a version that was very similar to the original version, which was an African song about the lion sleeping in the jungle. And if who knew that, if you put words to it, it could have been a big hit.
Yes, it's too bad you didn't get the hit that the Tokens got.
No, I know. Quite a few things that could have happened that didn't happen.
This next one could be a long story, but I'm sure you can condense it just a bit. But I wanted to talk about a very, very important thing happened to your group when one of your members, and I hope I don't pronounce his name wrong, Phil Krakalici, was arrested.
Krakalici.
Yeah, at a gas station in Brooklyn on December 4th, 1959. I mean, you can talk about that as much as you want to and let us know what happened.
Well, at the time, again, growing up in Brooklyn, we already had Hush Goodbye. We came off a tour. We were doing really, really great. At that point, we already recorded our second record, and Don't Take the Stars, as I just explained, was on the charts. And we were preparing for our third recording. In Brooklyn, we all hung out in either a candy store, or by this time we were a little bit older, we would hang out in the evenings at a gas station that was owned by a friend of ours. And we'd hang out and sing with some of the guys in the neighborhood. We were rarely in the neighborhood because we were always working. But when we were, we would have some fun and hang out with the guys and fix our cars and clean the cars and change the oil and sing and everything. This particular night that we're talking about, I was out on a date, so I didn't get there. But Phil and Alvy Krakalici, their brothers, they were in the gas station with some other guys, and they were hanging out as usual. And a couple of guys came in and held up the gas station. They did a stick up. They were going to rob the attendant and another guy who was working there. So what had happened is
armed robbery.
Young guys, an armed robbery. They came in they held up the gas station attendant who was fixing a tire at the time, and they held him up, and they put the gun in his pointed the gun at him, and said, "Come on, we want all your money." And he was shocked, of course, and from the story I gathered because of the people who were there. He had a tire iron in his hand, and he kind of like got jolted a little bit, and the tire iron hit the guy's arm who was holding the gun, and the gun fired, and it went into this attendant's head and killed him.
Wow.
Yeah, it was horrible. So of the noise of it all, now Bill and Albie and another guy were in a different room in the office. They were talking in the office, and this was in the garage part. And so the gun went off. They were startled. They ran in, and they see the guys holding the gun, and the guy on the floor who they knew, and, you know, bleeding. And so now the guys who pulled the robbery, Bill realized he knew these guys. They were from the neighborhood, but they were wise guys. They were tough guys. And they said to Phil and to the other guys, "Listen, you guys either better get out of here because we're going to take off, and you better not tell anybody that you saw us." So they run away, and it just so happens that car pulled, after they run away, a car pulls up for gas, and it was an off-duty cop, and he looks at the commotion, and he gets on the radio, he calls police, and the other police, and they all come, and they ask, "Dude, what happened?" He says, "I don't know, I was in the office, I didn't see anything." So, "Well, do you know who did it?" "No, I don't know who did it." So, unfortunately, what happened later is that police did a thorough investigation. I mean, I go into a lot of detail in the book, but
I read the story.
It'll take me 2 hours.
Anyway, Phil wound up going to jail for a while over this.
Well, he wound up because once they found, they scoured the neighborhood, they found a couple of guys, they coerced them into telling what happened, and when they told them what happened, they said, "Oh, yeah, we know Phil. And so now the cops went back to Phil and said, "Phil, you know, you lied, so now you're going to have to go to, I mean, he got arrested, they had to go to court."
Mm-hmm.
And in the court case, I'll try to abbreviate it, but in the court case, the judge would not let him go because of, he didn't tell the truth when they asked him if they knew the people that were, did the stick up. And then it got really involved. The court case got so involved, it was crazy. But ultimately what happened is Bill, the other guys did very, very stiff sentences. They went to prison, two guys went to life, and you know, it was bad.
Yeah.
But Phil got two years in upstate New York in a mediocre type of prison. But that was it. That took the wind out of our sails.
Yeah. So here's the mystics. You know, all of a sudden you're one of your members, main members, is gone, and you, in 1961, a couple of years later, you were pretty well towards the end, weren't you?
Oh, we didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
But we're trying to record a song. You know, trying to do our next recording. We had a show actually. That happened on February 3rd. We had a show about a week and a half later in Chicago, big show, and we had no lead singer, and we were scrambling, and we finally went and did the show, but it gets all very involved with the police trying to figure out how come Philly was there and not his brother, and it was all crazy. So there was all kinds of things going on, and we still had to record another song, and we had no lead singer. So I'll get into this part if you don't mind.
Right, go ahead. Yes.
Lee
yeah.
Finger.
Yeah.
So we had no Lee Finger, so we record company of, weeks and weeks went by because we actually thought that because Bill wasn't really involved that they were going to let him go, but they didn't let him go. So the record company and our manager said, look, you got to record. You have to continue doing this. And reluctantly, we said, okay, we'll go on. And we had selected a couple of songs for our third recording, which was All Through the One Through Which We All Through the Night, which kind of like when we first did it, it was a lead and background. And the record company said, listen, why don't we do this? Because if we thought that Phil was going to get out pretty quickly, that why don't we record this as a group, all singing the words in harmony together, and this way we can disguise the fact that Phil's not there in the group. And when he comes out, everything will be cool. Mm-hmm. But he didn't come out.
Right.
So we recorded the song, and my manager at the time said, well, you need a fifth voice, to fill in with the harmonies. And we said, yeah, we'd love to do that. And he found this young kid that was always hanging out. Jim Gribble's office was a hub of teenagers because, the Mystics had a hit record, the Passions had a record, the Classics would hang out.
Yeah.
So all the young people who would want to be singers would all come up and audition in the office. So my manager says, well, we're going to go into the studio next week, and so why don't you get that kid over there? And he's always here. He seems to have a good voice. And we said, okay. So we practiced with him, and we introduced ourselves, and, I said, well, so I know who you are. Okay, who are you? And we said, well, I'm Paul Simon.
Paul Simon.
Paul
Simon. Yes.
So we knew him as Jerry because he was recording as Jerry Landis, L-A-N-D-I-S. And he says, Paul Simon's my real name. It's all cool. So he didn't record anything as Paul Simon yet. He wasn't Paul Simon yet.
Yeah.
He was. And so we recorded with them a couple of recordings, and then and we let him go because he was only going to be just for the voice because we thought Phil was going to come out soon.
Yeah.
And he went on and did his own things,
Very famous. Yeah. 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 Who knew? And of course, he was actually with a group too, I believe, called Tom and Jerry.
Yeah. That's where he came. Jerry came.
Yeah, and then of course Simon and Garfunkel was later on.
Yeah. Incredible. Really incredible.
So much going, so much, so many great memories. And Al, I want to also ask you about the resurgence of this music that came in the late 60s. And were you surprised to see it? Of course, it kind of fell out after the Beatles came to popularity, but were you surprised to see this music come back?
We were surprised. We thought that it was over. Now, a lot of us fell into different things. I mean, because after the Beatles came in and the British music started to, there really wasn't a hell, as far as recordings go, nobody would want to record a duet or 50s or rock and roll, early rock and roll group. But all of a sudden, some of these shows were coming back and people wanted to go to shows, and guys like Richard Nader were bringing back all these big shows, and people were going. We were asked to get together and perform in some of these shows, and we're still doing it.
Well,
amazing.
Yeah, it is, and I appreciate you talking with us, Al. It's been great, and believe it or not, we've gone over an hour, but that's fine. We're gonna get this on the air,
my God.
And I really appreciate your talking about your career, and I really enjoyed reading your book. I'm going to look at it, read it again.
My pleasure. And so just let me say that the book is available in a couple of places. If you want a get the book, you can. I did an audio version, which I did the audio, I did the voiceover, and it's on audible.com.
Okay.
So it's pretty much available everywhere.
And the book's called Hush.
Yeah. And the book is called Hushabye, The Mystics, The Music, and The Mob.
Yeah.
And Denny, thank you so much. I enjoyed our conversation. And look forward to talking to you soon.
Well, thank you, Al. There's never been a better time to help support Wandering Press. It's a small town venture that reaches across a wide range. Since 1997, we have been dedicated to helping writers wishing to be published a real chance to be published. The publishing world is difficult to break into, and we try to maneuver around the obstacles and find the answers prospective authors need. In addition, we produce internet radio programs such as this one you're listening to right now. In 2011, Wandering Press initiated Depot Days, a series of summertime concerts on Grayville's riverfront, with proceeds going to local charities. All of this is done mostly through donations. Our sponsors are our most important asset. We humbly ask you to consider becoming one, either as an individual or a business sponsor. $20 is all it takes for a year's help. It isn't much, but a little turns into a lot when everyone who can help, helps. Sponsors will be credited on our Facebook page, and rotation ads will air on Wonder Mag On Air. All we need is $20 and a business card. Together we can continue to keep doing good work for the community. Contact us at Wandering Press, Post Office Box 153, Grayville, Illinois, 62844. Email wondermag2003@yahoo.com or call 618-375-1367. Thank you for your consideration.
Sugar shack, oh baby, do that sugar.
Not exactly the Sugar Shack, but I want to tell you about a great little shop near Grayville where you can get the snacks and drinks you need for your country drive. Judge's Snack Shack is now open on Webb's Ferry Road. They have ice cold drinks, chips, fresh farm eggs, honey, candy, ice cream, microwave foods, and much more. It's such a stone's throw from the Wabash River on Webb's Ferry Road, and Judge's Snack Shack never closes. It's open day and night on the honor system. All items are priced for your convenience. So it's a fine time for a drive through the country and a perfect time to stop by the Snack Shack where the treats are waiting for you. And now we close out episode 86 of Wonder Mag on Air. I want to thank my guest, Al Contrera, a member of the Mystics, and for being here talking about his book, Hushabye. And one song I want to close out with, very beautiful version of this. And I had never heard it before, but I'm told it was used in the HBO series, The Sopranos. And here is the Mystics, here are the Mystics, singing Over the Rainbow.
There's a rainbow in the sky. Oh, how I wish that I could fly somewhere. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why?